The Making of Mark Twain.
Twain didn't really want to fight a duel with anybody, and he said he really didn't have time to fight a duel that day, and besides, he'd been drunk when he wrote the article in the first place.
That's Roy Morris, Jr. We talked to him today about his book, Lighting Out for the Territory, how Samuel Clemens headed west and became Mark Twain.
These people who have a hard time getting involved, they got in their boats, went out in the bay in the middle of a storm, and did a protest, and it made headlines in the Houston Chronicle, and the chemical plant that I was fighting was so perturbed with me, he said, what is it going to take to shut her up?
And that's Diane Wilson. With the fate of the Gulf Coast shrimp industry in doubt as a result of a catastrophic BP oil spill, we replay a 2005 interview with Wilson. A shrimp boat captain turned environmental warrior, she went up against one of the biggest polluters in America to save the waters of the Gulf. Her book is An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The Mark Twain of the flowing white hair and big mustache we all know was made, not born. His real name was Samuel Clemens, and as a youth, Clemens tried his hand at a number of trades, from printer to riverboat captain and even gold miner. He was a clever lad, but didn't much like hard work. And when war broke out between the states, he found he didn't much like the idea of fighting either. Clemens grew up in the slave state of Missouri, and when the conflict began heating up, he went gallivanting off to the Wild West. He went out to the Nevada territories, joining the stream of Americans going west to make their fortunes. There, Clemens learned to bend his storytelling talent to the professional life of a writer. He got a job as a reporter for a newspaper, although it was more entertainment than journalism. Never let the facts, he was wont to say, get in the way of the story. He created himself as a character, the character Mark Twain. Roy Morris, Jr. has written a book about Sam Clemens and how he became Mark Twain. It's called Lighting Out for the Territory. Roy Morris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. Thanks for having me.
You're the editor of Military Heritage magazine, but here, as you say in your book, Lighting Out for the Territory, Mark Twain was, you could almost regard him as a deserter.
Right. His Civil War career was not exactly sterling. He, as I go into in the book, he spent probably about 2 weeks with a small group of Confederate Rangers called the Marion Rangers from his hometown of Hannibal, Missouri.
And he didn't seem to, he was on the Confederate side, of course, here, but not really with his heart in it.
No, not really. You know, of course, Missouri was a border state, and his own family was actually divided. His mother had been born and raised in Kentucky, and she was sort of a diehard Southern partisan. His brother Orion was an abolitionist and was actually had worked to help get Abraham Lincoln elected president. So even in his own in Twain's own family, there was a lot of argument.
So this is really the story of Sam Clemens more than Mark Twain, although it's really the story of him in some way becoming Mark Twain. It's a wonderful tale that you tell. First, tell us, how did Sam Clemens end up lighting out, as you say, for the territory of Nevada?
Well, it went back to the beginning of the Civil War. When the war started, he was working in New Orleans as a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi, and that's really where he expected to spend the rest of his life. He loved being a pilot. But when the war started, the river closed down to commercial traffic. And so Twain didn't want to get drafted into the Union or Confederate Navy. So he went to his sister's home in St. Louis and hid out there for a few weeks. And then went back to his hometown in Hannibal, Missouri, and that's where he got talked into joining the Marion Rangers with a group of his old boyhood friends.
Yeah, and his brother had something to do with this too.
Exactly. After about 2 weeks with the Marion Rangers, Sam Clements decided that he wasn't really cut out to be a soldier, which was probably a good thing for him to realize, because Missouri was about to become very dangerous as an area of warfare. Jesse James and Cole Younger and Bloody Bill Anderson and that whole group had not quite arrived on the scene yet, but were coming, and so Twain got out in the nick of time. And what happened was that his brother Orion had been appointed secretary to the governor of Nevada Territory because of his work for Abraham Lincoln. And so Mark Twain agreed to pay both their ways out west if Orion would let him go.
And tell us a little bit about Orion, his brother. He's a very prominent character in your book.
Right. Orion Clemens was 10 years older than Samuel. And he was actually more like their father, who had died when Sam Clemens was 11. And Orion was a very serious sort of fellow. And Sam actually took after their mother, Jane Lambton Clemens, who was very, very much the life of the party and kind of a natural-born storyteller. So you can kind of see how the two were very different in personalities. And their trip across the plains in a stagecoach is pretty hilarious, because the two brothers didn't really get along, and so they were kind of trapped with each other for the next 3 weeks.
As one reads this book, Lighting Out for the Territory, Roy Morris, Jr., one gets a sense of Sam Clemens, the future Mark Twain, as being kind of a feckless character, and his brother Orion as hapless. Is this really true?
Yes, or the Clemens family never seemed to have much luck with money. Their father had been a judge in Missouri, and he had bought a lot of land in Tennessee and managed to lose money on that. And Orion went through various jobs. He was a newspaper editor and a lawyer and a traveling salesman at one point. And this job as secretary to the governor of Nevada Territory was really the best job he ever had. And so Sam Clemens, and then later as Mark Twain, spent most of his adult life supporting Orion to one degree or another.
And as you say, they lit out for Nevada. They were joining quite a stream, a flood, you'd almost say, of whites out there. You say that one day the soldiers at Fort Laramie counted 39,000 people, more than 39,000 people, and 9,000 wagons going out west on this route. Why were people flooding out there at this time?
Well, the beginning of the great migration west, I guess, was really started by the gold rush in California, and that was about a dozen years before. But the people who went out for the gold rush, then they told everybody about the west, and so it was a huge migration across the plains and through the mountains and all the way to California. The route that Sam Clemens and Orion took was I think the northerly route of the ones that went out west. They went through what was in the Nebraska territory, and then down through Colorado and Utah and into Nevada.
And what kind of a place did they come to? They went out to Carson City. As I remember it, that was the first place they landed. That's where the seat of government was. What kind of a town were they coming into? What kind of situation?
Carson City was the seat of the government, the territorial government, and it was a fairly small town, and it was somewhat sedate by Wild West standards. Although, as I talk about in the book, when they arrived in Carson City, they were greeted by a welcoming committee and a gunfight and a windstorm. And the welcoming committee disappeared when they took one look at the Clemens brothers, who were still pretty weather beaten from their trip. A gunfighter named Harris rode up and was welcoming them to town when one of his enemies showed up on the street and they got into a gunfight. And Carson City had what was known as the Washoe Zephyr, which was a daily windstorm that blew down out of the mountains. And Mark Twain later wrote that it was about the size of the United States set edgewise.
Edgewise.
Right.
Now, there's a more serious aspect here to this great migration and the situation they found there. I have to say I was pretty shocked at the outright racism of Sam Clemens, the future Mark Twain, and others. I mean, here's someone I think of him as, you know, with Huckleberry Finn. He took a much more progressive position on race than many of his countrymen did at the time. But the attitude toward, tell us what was going on with the Indians there, how this, the contact between the whites and the Indians was happening and what Mark Twain said about that.
Well, you're right. He always seemed to have kind of a blind spot where it came to Native Americans. They were lucky. The timing of their trip out west was really just a few months before the Sioux and Cheyenne went on the warpath, because of so many white settlers, traveling across their territory. They were at peace at that point, and so the brothers, really the only Indians they came across on their trip were some Pawnee who were friendly to the whites. And a group of a tribe of Indians called the Goshutes, who were, as I say in the book, literally dirt poor. They lived in some really rough desert kind of land. And Twain didn't think much of them at all. I think he said that their days were spent stealing carrion from the coyotes and the other animals. He really didn't have a very very progressive view of Native Americans.
The book is Lighting Out for the Territory, How Samuel Clemens Headed West and Became Mark Twain. And we're talking with the author, Roy Morris, Jr. And we can also say that he mixed an awful lot of fiction into his fact. So even whatever he said of Indians, you can't really take as a reliable reporting.
Well, that's right. As I say in the book, just in general, never really let the facts get in the way of the story. And so you have to take everything he says with a certain grain of salt.
And so then he became a journalist. Now, he'd done some writing already, even though he wasn't a man who liked an actual fight, an actual battle. He was pretty lethal with his pen. How did he become a journalist, which was really, I think, what kicked off his career as a writer?
Exactly. He actually started working for Orion owned a newspaper in Hannibal called, I believe, the Hannibal Journal, and he started working there really when he was about 12 or 13. And when he went to New Orleans, he began contributing a few sketches to the newspaper there. So he had some training in the newspaper side. He also learned to be a printer and had worked on various papers in St. Louis and Cincinnati and some magazines in New York City before he headed west. So he kind of had a journalistic background, but he hadn't done a lot of real serious or steady writing until he joined. He was invited to join the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise, and that's where he really literally became Mark Twain in 1863.
You paint an incredible picture of that town, Virginia City, a boom town, a silver boom town. In fact, Mark Twain himself, before he became Mark Twain, had set out a stake, a silver stake, didn't do too well at it. So describe for our listeners what was the kind of atmosphere he came into and also the kind of journalism that they did, because I think it'd be fair to say it's pretty far from the standards of journalism we have today.
Right. Virginia City was your, more than Carson City, Virginia City was your typical boom town that everybody's familiar with. It was right at the epicenter of the Comstock Lode, which was the largest silver strike in American history. And so the town was full of prospectors and gunfighters and prostitutes and gamblers. And, there was a steady stream of people on both sides of the law. And so the Territorial Enterprise was really a lively newspaper, and at the time was really probably the best newspaper between St. Louis and San Francisco. So,
well, why do you say it was the best newspaper? But why? I mean, the editor and Twain, and I assume others, wrote a lot of stories that were complete and utter hoaxes.
Well, that's true. Best, I may mean, you know, mean more like the liveliest, because they were not real concerned with journalistic standards, although a lot of newspapers were the same way at the time. When Clemens joined the Enterprise, his mentor was an older reporter named William Wright, who went by the pen name of Dandy Quill, and Wright told him that gave him a piece of advice, which was that you first get the facts and then you can distort them all you want.
Yeah, in fact, you say it was up to the writer to open up a shallow vein of truth and then excavate whatever nuggets of amusement lay buried below. It's that shallow vein of truth that kind of got Mark Twain into trouble a couple of times.
Well, it did. He wrote a story, a real sensational story, one day, one of his first stories for the Enterprise, about a leading citizen who named Hopkins, who supposedly had gone crazy one night and massacred his whole family and scalped his wife and ridden into town and realized what he did and cut his own throat out of remorse. And everybody was horrified by the story until they noticed that the Hopkins family seemed to be walking around hale and hearty. So Twain wrote an article the next day, a retraction that said, in total, I take it all back.
And he could do this with complete insouciance and not see anything wrong with it.
No, he looked on it really more as entertainment than you know, hard and fast journalism, and I think people kind of expected that to one degree or another. But he got into more serious trouble when he accused one of the rival editors at another newspaper of reneging on its promise to support the Union war effort, and this editor challenged him to a duel, and Twain, being Twain, didn't really want to fight a duel with anybody, and he said he really didn't have time to fight a duel that day, and besides, he had been drunk when he wrote the article in the first place.
Yeah, and why was this such a hot potato? I mean, you'd think that the first one would be just as serious. You make an out-and-out whopper about something that never happened, a murder that never happened. But this thing really blew up in his face. Why was that?
Well, I think because it was political, and with the war going on, there was a lot of tension in Nevada over between pro-Confederate and pro-Union factions, and the Union newspaper, as its name indicated, was staunchly Unionist. And the editor, whose name I believe was Laird, really took offense, especially coming from a former Confederate like Mark Twain.
A former Confederate, yes, but didn't his brother owe his position to Abraham Lincoln? So wouldn't Nevada be on the side of the Union?
Well, it was for the most part. You're right. There was a pro-Confederate contingent, but they were pretty well dominated by Northern sentiment, and Twain really he didn't make a big deal out of having been a former Confederate himself. Don't get me wrong, he didn't talk much about the war until years later when people he met Ulysses S. Grant and William Sherman and a lot of the famous Union generals, and of course after the war everybody wanted to know what, you know, what you had done in the war, and that's when he kind of went back and wrote this article that that described very very kind of misleadingly his Civil War career.
And now you mentioned before the pen names, you know, his nom de plume, of course, being Mark Twain. But before he got Mark Twain, he tried out some pretty strange pen names. Epaminondas, Adrastus Blab, I don't even know how to pronounce that.
Right, yeah, he tried out, he called himself Epaminondas Adrastus Blab, and Peter Pencilcase's son, Rambler, Grumbler, Sergeant Fathom, even called himself at one point a dog bedeviled citizen.
And where did Mark Twain come from?
Well, Mark Twain is an old Mississippi River saying, which meant two fathoms, which was 12 feet deep, and that was the depth at which a riverboat could pass safely over a sandbar. And Twain himself claimed that he had actually gotten the name from another journalist in New Orleans who had used it first, but nobody's ever been able to find any previous bylines of any Mark Twain until he started using it in Virginia City in I believe February of 1863.
One of Twain's most famous stories came from his time in the Western Territories, the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. I asked Roy Morris about the provenance of this tale.
Mark Twain had been, after he left Virginia City, he went to San Francisco, and he worked for the newspaper there for a few months, but he said that was too hard work for him. So he went to visit some friends who were working at an old mining camp in Calaveras County, about 50 miles east of San Francisco. And one of them was a great storyteller, and he told this long involved story about a champion jumping frog that had been secretly filled with buckshot so they couldn't jump, and in order to win a bet from a gambler, and so Twain immediately thought that would be a great story, and in fact he said if he could just tell it like he heard it, that that it would jump all around the world, and he was right, because celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County was picked up by newspapers all across the country, and really that was his first brush with national fame.
Yeah. He also was really supported in his work by Bret Harte. Tell us who Bret Harte was, and how did he get to meet him?
Well, Bret Harte was a writer who had also gone west and settled in San Francisco and became famous for his stories that he wrote about the Gold Rush, Outcasts of Poker Flats, Tennessee's Partner, The Luck of Roaring Camp, and several stories that became very famous. And he was editing a literary magazine out in San Francisco called The Californian, and he and Twain became friends, and then he really gave him a boost in terms of another more prestigious journal to write for. They became great friends, but then in later years they became great enemies. Twain said later that Bret Harte was the most pleasant man he ever met, and Bret Harte was the most unpleasant man he ever met.
Why was that?
They just really didn't. Well, their falling out started when they tried to write a play together based on Bret Harte's a famous poem about the heathen Chinese, and the play was a big failure on Broadway, and I think they blamed each other for it. And then there was an issue, I think, when Bret Harte spent some time with the Twain family in Connecticut, and was sort of a house guest who wouldn't leave, and got on Mark Twain's nerves, and so it kind of went downhill from there.
Hmm. Now, he also witnessed he was there for the San Francisco earthquake, is that right?
Well, he wasn't there for the huge one in 1906, although he was still alive and wrote about it, but he was there. I think he experienced his first earthquake when he'd been there about a week, and he actually started something he called the Daily Earthquake Almanac. And so he would recount the strength of whatever earthquakes he felt or imagined or invented.
Now, you know, in writing this book, you obviously enjoy Mark Twain hugely. But this is no hagiography. I mean, you're very clear about his faults and foibles.
Well, I tried to be. I mean, he's one thing people ask me what surprised me about Mark Twain, and one of the things that really surprised me was that he had absolutely no sense of humor about himself. Like a lot of comedians, he liked to tell jokes and tease other people, but when it came to him, he was really he didn't appreciate being the butt of humor.
Yeah, right. In fact, I think there was at one point where he had told a whopper when he was still over at Virginia City, and his editor apologized because he was out sick that day, the next day after there was his huge furor, and he was not amused.
No, his friend Clement Rice, who was another editor there, and they had kind of a mock feud going anyway. Twain called Rice the unreliable and made him kind of the comic figure in a bunch of ridiculous adventures. And so one day when Twain was gone, Rice took advantage and wrote this fulsome apology for a story that Twain had written and signed Twain's name to it. And he was definitely not amused when he came back.
You must have, of course, used a lot of Twain's own writings to do the research for your book. How did you know if what you were reading of his report was true or not?
Well, that's always one of the real challenges in dealing with Twain, and you pretty much have to factor in that he's never going to tell exact truth. And so what you try to do is then go and read. Actually, his letters are more factual than the truth because he's writing. He's writing in the time, and he's writing home, or he's writing to friends, and so you can kind of double check that, and then other people's accounts are you sort of look at them too. So it's always a question of sort of factoring in by some degree the amount of truth and legend that is involved.
Hmm. What was the most fun thing about doing this book?
Oh, it's just fun dealing with Mark Twain. I always say that I don't think a day went by that he didn't make me laugh out loud by something he said or wrote or did or had done to him. He's just an hilarious person, and of course, as Ernest Hemingway said, you know, all of modern American writing really comes from Mark Twain, because he was the first great writer to write in the authentic kind of American Western Southwestern voice, and so it was a lot of fun for me as an old English major myself to be able to read and see how he developed his style.
Well, the book is Lighting Out for the Territory, How Samuel Clemens Headed West and Became Mark Twain. Thanks so much, Roy Morris, Jr., for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me, Francesca. I enjoyed it.
Roy Morris, Jr. is the editor of Military Heritage magazine and the author of four books on the Civil War and post-Civil War eras, including Fraud of the Century and The Better Angel. You can read Mark Twain's tale, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we air a 2005 interview with Gulf Coast shrimp boat captain and environmental activist Diane Wilson. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we find ourselves riveted by scenes of BP's epic oil spill catastrophe unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico, the spreading plume, the dying birds, the grieving fishermen, it may come as a surprise that toxic pollution is not new to the area. Long before the Deepwater Horizon disaster, chemical plants started spewing poisons into the Gulf, threatening shrimp fisheries, wildlife, and residents. Diane Wilson started shrimping on the Texas Gulf Coast with her family at the age of 8 and became a shrimp boat captain when she was 24. She's been an environmental activist since 1989 when she took on Formosa Plastics, then one of the biggest polluters in the U.S. Her 2005 book, An Unreasonable Woman, describes her struggle to preserve a way of life that is now even more endangered and may never recover. Writer's Voice spoke to her in October of 2005, not long after Hurricane Katrina hit the coast. That was the last time the shrimp fishing industry was devastated. I was joined on the interview by Daisy Mathias, who was Writer's Voice co-host at that time.
Since Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, I believe the U.S. government declared the Gulf Coast fisheries a total disaster, and it impacted all the way from Mississippi all the way down to Texas. And the fishermen, a lot of the fishermen, like, for instance, from Louisiana, they will pick up shrimp from Texas and take it to packing plants in Louisiana. And when you've got these packing plants that are totally wiped out, the docks are gone, and the getting fuel is in a crisis, not only are you impacting all of the shrimp boats and the packing plants that were destroyed in Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi, it impacts everything that's going on in Texas.
You were born there, is that
right?
That's right. What's the land like? What's it like? And tell us a little bit about your family, too.
Oh, well, I'm fourth generation. I was born and raised in all me and my brothers and sister. There were seven of us, and we were born in our own little home, and my great-grandfather was a fisherman, and matter of fact, he abandoned my grandpa out on Blackjack Island, so in my he was an Indian, and so my grandfather grew up on Blackjack Island. That's where my dad was born, actually, and all of us have been in Seadrift. All of my brothers were shrimpers. My dad was a shrimper. I started shrimping on a shrimp boat when I was 8 years old. I used to would go out in the bay, and we used to spend the night out there because sometimes when a norther would come through, the shrimp would bunch, and you could expect maybe you were really going to get a good catch. And so I would spend the night on top of a shrimp boat with a norther blowing in.
It was unusual to have a woman be a shrimp boat captain, though. Right?
Oh, it was very rare for a woman to be a shrimp, but still is very rare. There are women out there, but they're usually the deckhands. The men are at the wheel, and the women, they put on the, as they call it, the stupid end of the stick, and they stick them out on the deck and just say, keep your fingers nimble and keep your mouth shut. And women were, they were very good deckhands.
So you've been an unreasonable woman for many years.
Oh, yeah. in many fields.
So what changes have you seen in the Gulf over the years? Now, this is a place where you've had to share as a shrimp boat captain and a shrimper. Is that what you would call it?
That's right.
As a shrimper, you've had to share this territory increasingly, it seems, with chemical plants.
Oh, yeah. Like the chemical plants started coming, like Union Carbide came down like in 1950. There was Alcoa that was there in 1950. And Alcoa was the one that was, they had a process that they were making, but they used these mercury cells, and it generated a lot of mercury. Matter of fact, they don't do it anymore, and because it's such a, it puts out such a waste of mercury, and mercury is right now is getting directly linked with autism. But in those days, they had all these cells, and they were totally out of control. Matter of fact, the workers in the unit were, there was so much mercury, their wives had to drive them to work because the workers couldn't even drive a car.
Now, one of your sons has had some issues with autism.
Well, yeah, he's got a major issue with autism. He was born that way. And I know when he was first born, they thought maybe he was blind or he was deaf. And then they gradually diagnosed him with autism.
How's he doing now?
Davy Crockett's doing, that's his name. I used to sing Davy Crockett to him. He liked that song. David's doing real well, a lot better than most children. And he's, matter of fact, he's taken a couple of college courses. He loves mechanical things, computers. I think he relates to them more than human beings, which is a lot of autism's, you know, as social problems, a lot of that.
Yeah, that's right. So as a mother, and you're the mother of five children.
That's right. Five of them.
That's pretty amazing in itself.
That's right.
What's their age range right now?
Well, right now they're all the way from 30 all the way down to 19.
Wow. Did you make a connection between the pollution and your son's condition?
Well, I remember when I first started, like maybe my second meeting, I had called this meeting and I had this group of people. They were economic development. They were the mayors. They were chamber of commerce. And they came in and just absolutely disrupted the whole meeting. And they said I was a hysterical woman. I didn't know what I was talking about. I was making it all up. And I was telling them about my concern because there's a lot of learning disabilities. You know, my own son was autistic. And so I knew a lot. There was a lot of families with learning disabilities and problems with their children. And I said, well, we were really concerned about what the possible impacts to our children. And there was a woman there and she stood up and she said, well, she was from the school district and she'd never heard of pollution having anything to do with learning disabilities. And the only thing she knew that was related to that, I guess it was when you end up marrying your cousins, a genetic. I mean, it was like a slap in the face that, you know, they came in like they were slumming. You know, they come into our fishing town.
We've never heard of this, and therefore you must be crazy.
That's right.
The old blame the victim strategy.
Oh, yeah. Usually works that way, too.
So for most of plastic, those were the guys that you went up against. Tell us something about this firm. Tell us a story about how you found out about it.
Well, in the beginning, when I first started, I had no idea of any of the chemical companies out there because I was a fisherwoman. I fished on the bays and I took care of my kids. But when I found out our county was number one in the nation, I started doing a little research. And then I found out a lot of the reason why there was such a controversy is that this great state of Texas was bringing down one of the worst polluters in the world. Matter of fact, at that period, like 1989, Taiwan was known, the only thing that was keeping pace up with their economic development was their environmental destruction. And that at that time, the Kuomintang was still running the government. I mean, the newspapers were owned, a lot of the factories were owned. And this man, Chairman Wong, who owned Formosa Plastics, he was the 11th richest man in the world, and his pollution was so bad that villagers under the Kuomintang government, they rioted and throwed rocks at him, and he was so outraged. Well, he was here. By gosh, he was going to go Texas and Louisiana, and we just fought to get him down here.
What do you mean by you fought to get him down
here? Well, what I mean is the state of Texas and Louisiana, they were doing everything in the sun to get Formosa into their state. So Texas and Louisiana was doing this all-out wrestling match over what could they give to get them down, and Texas got him because we gave them $250 million in tax abatements.
And they saw that as economic development, but they weren't counting the pollution costs.
Oh, they absolutely did not even look into it. I know a reporter asked economic development, and it says, well, did you know this was a number one polluter? And he says, well, we're economic development. That is not our place to ask questions like that.
Well, now, when you said that your county was number one, you meant number one in being polluted.
That's right. Yeah. It was actually the reason why I got on my environmental hat, if you want to call it that, is because it was the first time the toxic release inventory had ever been made public. And a shrimper with, because at that time shrimping was so bad, I was running a fish house, and I had one of my shrimpers, and he had three different types of cancer. He had these big lumps underneath his skin like tennis balls, and he brought me this story, Associated Press, and it said that our county, which was Calhoun County, was number one in the nation for toxic disposal to the land. And we're only ranking number one in toxic disposal to the land. We were ranking in injection wells, where you put it down in wells. We were ranking in air emissions out in the air. We were ranking in them taking the waste and transferring it over to another county. So our little county is like 15,000, and we were ranking all over the place, and that just blew my mind.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're playing a 2005 interview with Texas Gulf Coast shrimp boat captain and environmental advocate Diane Wilson. Her book, An Unreasonable Woman, was published by Chelsea Green Press. I was joined on the interview by Daisy Mathias, who co-hosted Writer's Voice with me in 2005.
How many tons of chemicals are you talking about here?
Oh, wow. Let me see. I think Alcoa actually was the plant that landed us on the toxic release inventory as the number one. And that one plant, Alcoa, had 51% of the entire state's total emissions to the land. And the thing it is I know the toxic release inventory is a real good deal, and people read toxic release inventories, they say, oh, wow, well, maybe we're gaining a little bit, or, you know, and the chemical plants will say, you know, we're doing real good because, you know, we're not up there number one anymore. And the thing is, we were number one 1 year. The next year, we weren't there, and it was because the chemical companies and the politicians went to the EPA, who was a politician's campaign manager, and they delisted it. They just pulled it right off. That's how you get rid of waste.
Wow. Yeah, by pulling it off the list?
Yeah, take it off the list.
Wow. Right. By another kind of pull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said that you were running a shrimp house because there weren't that many shrimp around.
That's right.
Is there a connection here that we're paying?
Well, I think there's a big connection in it. And it's a real tragedy, too, because I remember when I was very, very young, and the shrimpers had a real tradition. There was a real moral stance they had about how they shrimped, that they only went out on the beginning of, as a matter of fact, it was like a celebration, like the first day of shrimp season. They would go out the night before. They would all tie up together, and it was like this ritual. I can still remember how fantastic and all that brotherhood of the shrimpers. And you never went after small shrimp. You never shrimped at night. And then the chemical plants were there, and you were starting getting the brown tides and the green tides and the red tides. And we had dolphin die-offs, and we had fish that were literally trying to climb out of the water. And then sometimes the shrimper in the estuary sometimes in the beginning of a season, and a shrimper could go and he could put over a little trinet, which is a little bitty, like a 10-foot or a 5-foot net, and just to see what the season is going to be like. And the shrimp would be there 1 week, and the next week, they were gone. I mean, they're vanished. They didn't move. They vanished.
Where did they go?
Well, that's a good question. The only thing is I can tell you is a number of years ago, all the shrimp in Galveston Bay, they literally vanished overnight. And it was such a extraordinary event that it was even in the, I mean, they even did an editorial at the Houston Chronicle about all the shrimp disappearing in Galveston Bay, which is a big bay, and there's a lot of shrimpers there, and they just vanished. And it was probably a couple months later, I was in Austin talking to, I think it was Texas Water Commission at that time, and I mentioned that, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, we know about that. He said, there was a chemical, and we tracked it all the way to Union Carbide, and it was a chemical. They had a big spill, and it wiped out the shrimp.
You were a shrimp boat captain, then you worked in your brother's fish house.
That's right.
Are you shrimping now?
Well, one of my final actions, I was fighting Formosa Plastics wastewater permit, and I had fought it all the way to the appellate court in Washington, D.C., and come to find out, here I was fighting their permit, because they couldn't discharge at that point. And I was talking with the EPA woman attorney, and I had the same name as Formosa's woman lawyer. And so she thought she was talking to Formosa's lawyer. And so she was just talking about this discharge. They were putting millions of gallons, and they didn't have a permit, and the EPA knew it, and was like, oh, except the only party that didn't know it was me. And I'd been fighting them for about 4 years, and I was so outraged that I had to do something, and the only thing I could think of was to take my shrimp boat and take the motor out. In the dead of night, I had a shrimper pull my shrimp boat all the way around to Formosa Discharge, and I was going to drop it. I was going to sink it right on top of that illegal discharge because I was outraged. I was outraged. It's like federal law, nothing, you know, it didn't matter. They were going to get their permits. They were going to do what they wanted. And we were supposed to, as citizens and as fishermen who lived on the bay, we were supposed to just take it, accept it. And I refused to accept it. So, I don't have a shrimp boat no more.
And so you did that?
Yeah. Well, I was on my way of sinking it, and I had a cousin who, you know, when industry finds out who is opposing them, they find out who all their allies are. So they knew the fishermen were probably my allies. So they proceeded to get my cousin, who was at that time the spokesperson for the fishermen, and they hired him for $65,000 a year to be a spokesperson for them and just to follow me around, see what I was up to. And he told them I was taking my shrimp boat out there in the middle of the night to sink it on top of their discharge. So they told the Coast Guard, and I had 3 boatloads of Coast Guard catch me at midnight in a stormy sea. Like a norther had blown in. It was wild as a March hare. And the Coast Guard said I was a terrorist on the high seas and $500,000 in penalties and 19 years in the penitentiary. And here Formosa was discharging illegally.
But they weren't getting any penalties.
No.
You didn't get convicted of them.
well, what happened
is they
confiscated my boat and had me kind of tied up at the docks. And the interesting thing is that it was having such a hard time getting fishermen involved because they are in such a crisis and they are so depressed and they do not believe anything will save them anymore. But when they saw the Coast Guard hauling me in and all, I had this about 19 walking all over there and giving me citations and this and that. These people who have a hard time getting involved, they got in their boats, went out in the bay in the middle of a storm and did a protest, and it made headlines in the Houston Chronicle. And the chemical plant that I was fighting was so perturbed with me. He said, what is it going to take to shut her up? Mm-hmm. And so I got zero discharge from them.
Zero discharge.
That's right.
It's where
all of these chemical plants have discharges, and they have wastewater discharges, and they average around 5 million gallons per day of toxins of everything from vinyl chloride to benzene to chlorine to you name it.
So they're allowed to discharge a certain amount of toxic waste?
A certain amount, but the thing that is, they do their own monitoring, so
nobody else is monitoring them.
No, they're their own monitor. Every once in a while, the EPA or the state says, hey, they're fixed to come down. And so suddenly, you know, things get shut off and everything is just generally peachy. Sometimes
these are called voluntary controls.
Voluntary controls.
So
yes.
How well do they work?
I don't think they work at all, quite frankly.
So when the inspectors do come down, the plant's been forewarned,
and
they shut it off.
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, I've had some fellas talk, and this was just for OSHA, that OSHA was coming down, and they were given like 2 weeks of warning. The fellas came in and said, okay, you fellas, all our places where we need to fix this, you clean it spick and span. And the fella didn't show up to noon, and he made a fast walkthrough through the whole thing, and then the plant manager took him to dinner.
You're hearing an interview with Diane Wilson about her book, An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. Wilson was a Gulf Coast shrimp boat captain who became an environmental activist when she found that her livelihood was threatened by toxic pollution in the Gulf of Mexico. Although she eventually won the support of many of her fellow shrimp boaters, she also faced opposition from others in her community.
It came from a lot of different directions. Some of it came from the fact that I was just a woman, and for where I come from, for a woman to get out front and speak and call meetings, you know, because I remember a lot of people, well, they would go up to my husband at that time, and they'd say, why can't you control that woman of yours? And, you know, and then he would get real upset and was like, why couldn't he control me? So I would get that angle, and then I would get a lot. It became a class issue. It was like she was a fishing woman, and is like she doesn't really know what she's talking about. And so I started getting this, that I was just this low class, they're uneducated, that I didn't know nothing, and then why don't you stay home, you don't know what you're messing with. And then I started getting the stuff, the political stuff, because they just absolutely did not want any laundry, dirty laundry. You know, I even had the bank president, and he would come down, and naturally he had been talking to industry, and he'd say, well, you know, we just can't have this dirty laundry being aired, and what you need to do is, you know, and they would offer me all kinds of little bribes if I would just sit down and let industry control it, and I could be the head, and they would let me be the head, and I would get a little salary and pay for everything. You know, and anybody that tried to join up, you know, if they were trying to get a loan at the bank, suddenly they couldn't get a loan at the bank because corporations were sitting on as directors of the banks. You know, if you had a cousin that worked at the plant, suddenly they were fingered. One of my board of directors, who was my brother, he quit shrimping because it was so bad and started working for the plant.
For Formosa Plastics.
And my other brother, he was afraid the fish house was going to be burned down, so he fired me.
So were you ever tempted to take any of those bribes, and how did you withstand it? I mean, you're not exactly rolling in dough yourself.
I'm one of those people that the only thing that has meaning for me is integrity. I feel like that's the only thing that I have, and I have a real sense of family with that bay, and I have a brotherhood with the fishermen, and I felt it was a moral path I was working, so it became real important that I did the right thing. And actually, a lot of the way that I could tolerate it is I was reading Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and you put it on a much bigger perspective, and it becomes the hero's journey, and it's not just these little people arguing or little pieces of money or little salary. It becomes much bigger. It becomes a mythic journey, and I felt that I was on the hero's journey. That's what I felt I was doing.
Are you still living in Seadrift, Texas?
I wouldn't leave any other place. I love that town.
So ultimately, well, when you're on the hero's journey, you can end up inspiring a whole lot of other folks, too. Do you think that's something, I mean, I can imagine that modesty might lead you to say, no, I never inspired anyone. But, you know, really, taking a look at it, what about the support? Did that come to you?
The support at the town, like I had the instance where the fishermen got behind me, and I even had this time where I got the entire fishing community behind me. But long term, it's still been very difficult. It's not like you get them one time and you got them the rest of the time. It's a gradual thing, and I think a lot a lot of it is that, like, I couldn't ever get a local newspapers, you know, they just would not give me any credibility at all. So sometimes I would get outside attention, you know, it's this thing about the prophet is not valued in his own land, and that's true. But sometimes they'd see, like, a Houston Chronicle giving me credibility, and they're like, taken aback. It's come through strange directions.
This was the first time activism for you, wasn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah. I was not an activist. I'm not a joiner. I'm still having a real tough time being a joiner. You know, in the beginning, I used to think I was absolutely the wrong person for this. I kept thinking, I'm the wrong person. You know, I don't like talking. I really, really don't. And I didn't like having meetings, and I didn't like having to deal with people. And I just wanted the solitude of the Bay. And I kept thinking, there's got to be someone out there who knows this better, who's smarter, who's better educated. And about 3 or 4 years later, I realized I was the perfect person. And it was because I had a passion for the Bay. And it was my passion that was the real important thing.
You described in the book how difficult it was for you to stand up in front of meetings and,
oh, yeah.
and talk with people. And,
yeah.
But obviously you got past that because it was important enough to you.
Well, it was. And like I said, I'm really, really not a speaker, because when I was in elementary school, I had like 6 years of speech therapy. I can remember when I absolutely eliminated the alphabet. It was like I couldn't even approach it. I know that's a strange thing, but it was something when I was young. And so I couldn't even talk because I couldn't approach the alphabet. I couldn't approach the letters. And when I was in high school, I don't think I said a word the entire 3 or 4 years. So it was very difficult for me to talk. And a lot of times I got a son that's autistic. And sometimes I think maybe I had a silent gene in myself that I passed that on to him. I really did. But the thing of it is, when there is something that means so much to you, you do it. And it's like, and I can remember I was shaking. Sometimes I was shaking so much I was surprised I was standing. And I remember one time it was a meeting with the head, the administrator of the EPA out of Washington, and all of these national groups people, and they let one little grassroots, and they let me in. And I nearly cried. I nearly cried in front of him.
Well, we were talking earlier before the program began about how you always feel protective of your children.
That's right.
Especially if you have a child who's in trouble, the mother tiger kind of thing. And it sounds to me like you're a mother tiger about your Bay.
Oh, I am. I very much am. Matter of fact, sometimes I almost felt like it was fate. It was like I could see the Bay, and she was a woman, and it was like she put the circumstances out that I would be her fighter.
Diane Wilson speaking to Writer's Voice in 2005. Her book is An Unreasonable Woman, out from Chelsea Green Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.